This is Naked Astronomy, and still to come, we'll meet MIRI, the mid-infrared instrument due to fly on the James Webb Space Telescope. But first, with a roundup of exciting news from the Royal Astronomical Society, here's Robert Massey.
Well, one of the meetings we had here at the RAS was focused on the history of astronomical imaging. Now, of course, a couple of years ago, we had the 400th anniversary of the use of the telescope for astronomy. And of course, as soon as telescopes were invented and pointed at the night sky, it then became of vital importance to actually record what people were seeing. And of course, for more than two centuries, the only way of doing that was to record it by drawing what you saw, or in some cases, painting and making quite elaborate imagery. And it was only really in the second half of the 19th century with the invention of photography and then digital imaging in the latter part of the 20th century, and now obviously in the century we're in today, that changed. So there was a really long period of time when people depended on trying to depict as accurately as they could, although doubtless with quite a lot of artistic license, what they saw, and doing that with pen and ink or with a paintbrush.
I assume that these would have been people who also had an interest in things like cartography. So actually the ability to accurately draw things had developed long before we were pointing telescopes at the sky.
That's entirely true, but there does seem to be a sort of distinct pattern in the way that people did it. And for example, Thomas Harriot, who made some of the earliest sketches of the moon, was very much about precision in alignment and making sure things were in the right place. Whereas Galileo, for example, had an artist training, and he was very good at actually depicting, if you look at, for example, his illustrations of the moon, what the moon looked like, or giving a sense of that. But he was actually less good on getting things to scale. So it really depends to some extent, I think, on your background as to how you decided to run things forward. And it becomes increasingly complicated. If you look at the kind of maps, for example, the moon that were developed in the second half of the 17th century, they're fiendishly complicated. They've got superimposed detail, let alone as you go into the 18th and 19th century. And it gets harder and harder as time goes on. So it does illustrate really just how much it depends on what the observer actually thinks they're seeing, their perception, and how they translate that to the page.
And presumably the advantage with the modern techniques we have is that they are, to an extent, objective. That's
exactly right. I think the big change with the advent of photography was that you can have enormously long discussions about whether, you know, a photograph is really an accurate depiction of something or not. But if you're both using the same technique, if two observers use the same technique and they take a picture with the same kind of camera and the same film, then at least that kind of uncertainty is taken out of it. So in the sense of the scientific process, it standardizes something, and that had to be a great value in the way these things were understood. Of course, the downside is that the eye is actually extremely good at seeing really fine detail, and cameras, at least to begin with, weren't as good as that. You know, they were very good at long exposures, but the right up till, I guess, the 1980s and beyond with the CCDs, the kind of things you find in modern digital cameras, actually, it was quite difficult to see very fine planetary detail. And to get that, actually, the drawing by hand was still one of the best ways to record it.
We've also had a bit of a discussion about what we should do about near-Earth objects. Now, first of all, tell me what we mean by these. These are things that potentially could get a bit too close.
It's a sort of perennial discussion, really. There's occasionally the worry bubbles up about the fact that the solar system, unfortunately, is not just populated by the sun and eight planets and a few of the small objects. There are an awful lot, literally, well, it's fair to say millions of other things flying around there as well. Now, you know, you can also say that the solar system is mostly empty because the distribution of these things is very wide, but there are nonetheless, perhaps, you know, 8,000 objects in the vicinity of the Earth that are known at the moment that go around the sun in paths that take them sometimes right across the Earth's orbit, sometimes between Earth and Mars, and sometimes within the orbit of the Earth. They're what you'd describe in other circumstances as asteroids. So often they're referred to as near-Earth asteroids, but some of them are a bit more like comets as well, and some of them are so small that they're more like boulders. But there's a lot of this stuff out there, and so it isn't surprising that now and again, some of it hits us.
And what's being proposed? What should we do about it?
Well, this is almost like the billion-dollar question, perhaps, in terms of the amount of money you'd need to spend. There are really good projects to monitor them, and the various robotic telescopes and Space Guard project, and there's a robotic one by the name of Linear, for example. All of these are automatically scanning the skies, looking for objects that move from one night to the next, cross-referencing them against existing asteroid orbits we know about. and then, you know, attempting to identify new ones. And these have found thousands of these objects already. And even in terms of the subcategory of what we call potentially hazardous asteroids, and much as you might imagine, this describes things that could actually hit the Earth, something like 1,200 of those have been found already. The good news is that very few of them present any immediate threat at all, and even the one or two that there's a marginal risk attached to, you're looking at quite a long time in the future and quite a low risk. But, of course, we know, unfortunately, from these kind of surveys that there are lots of objects that are slightly smaller than this, and being smaller, they reflect less sunlight, and that means they're fainter. And we're pretty sure there's an awful lot of those that we haven't found yet.
What sorts of ideas are we putting forward that would actually help to save us? I'm assuming that we're not going for the Hollywood Armageddon style.
I don't think we'll be hiring Bruce Willis to do this one. But and the reason for that simply is actually if you put a bomb in the center of one of these objects and exploded it, well, yes, you'd get a lot of smaller pieces, but unfortunately most of those would still be on a collision course with the Earth, and it might just make the damage worse. But there are more serious suggestions, none of which have been tried, of course. There's what sounds like an exotic idea anyway, where you use a large space probe as a kind of tractor, a gravitational tractor. Now, there'll be a minuscule pull between the space probe and the asteroid sent to intercept. But if it sits in the right place, it could tug it off course over a period of many years, and that might just be enough to deflect it. The other idea is to attach a sort of a low-level thruster to the side of an object and fire it for a long period of time in the same way and give it a gentle nudge. And the most violent approach is to use something like a bomb where you explode it near it. Again, perhaps if you had a problem in this, you know, you didn't have much notice of one of these things, and to give it a more violent push. But the crucial thing and the best way to approach it is to give them a gentle nudge out of the way in plenty of time, so that if you then look back at it and say, 30 years' time, if that's the time it's predicted to hit, it'll have moved out of the way and won't be a problem.
And also, this month we've seen in the skies above northern Britain some fantastic displays of the aurora. This is very rare to get them as far south as we've actually seen them. What's happening on the sun?
Well, we're coming up towards a period of time known as sunspot maximum, when, as the name implies, the number of sunspots that you can see it rises to a high level. Now, I should stress that it's not safe to look at the sun directly. You need to project the image or buy a filter from an astronomy supplier, and it's not something to do if you're not sure about it. It's best to get advice first. But if you observe the sun, what you notice is the number of dark spots, the cooler regions on the surface, is higher at certain periods than other. There's an 11-year cycle, and we're ramping up to one of those maxima now. And at the same time that you get more sunspots, you tend to get more energetic outflows of material. Things called solar flares, which are large explosions on the surface, and also coronal mass ejections, where a lot of material is ejected out through the sun's atmosphere, the corona, and right out into space, and quite often ends up in the vicinity of the Earth. Now, that CME, that coronal mass ejection, travels quite quickly, perhaps 2,000 kilometers a second. It's made up of charged particles, and if you move a charged particle, it generates a magnetic field. And what that means is that if you get a lot of those slamming into the Earth's magnetic field, it bounces it around. It basically distorts it, and it recovers and snaps around. And that has effects on the upper atmosphere of the Earth, such that you get atoms there where electrons, part of the particles of atoms, are knocked down through energy levels or excited and then de-excite. And as they do that, they generate light. Basically, a photon of light comes out and you get a characteristic green or red display, and actually extraordinarily beautiful if you've ever seen them. And that's what people in the north of England and Scotland have been lucky enough to see this week.
Extra activity on the sun may produce these beautiful displays, but it can also be quite risky, for certainly for things that we have out in orbit, but also for power networks down here on Earth. Is that something we need to be worried about as the sun's activity steps up?
It's certainly something that we need to be aware of. The problem with a space weather event is that the Earth's magnetic field fluctuates, and that can trigger a number of effects. Firstly, you get enhanced radiation in space, literally the stuff coming from the sun. And if you're an astronaut on a spacewalk, that might be a problem. It can also have a direct effect on satellites, and sometimes they need to be rebooted or the software needs to be reconfigured, because the charged particles can change the logic states on the chip, so 0 to 1 or 1 to 0, so it can corrupt the software. So perhaps next time your window manager shuts down, it might be reasonable to blame it on the sun as well as the software writer. But actually, the more serious problem is that on the ground you can see interference with GPS systems, partly because the satellites might be affected, partly because it interferes with the upper atmosphere of the Earth that radio waves travel through, and it distorts them. You can also see power outages, and that's because if you get a fluctuation in the Earth's magnetic field, it induces currents in power lines, and that additional load can cause generators to pack up and transformers to pack up. And if you don't mitigate that, if you're not aware of it and you don't think about ways to deal with it, you can actually get real blackouts. And that happened in Quebec in 1989 and also in Sweden a few years later. So it is a real problem. That's not to say that we should worry unduly about it, but it's certainly something that needs to be tackled and something that engineers have to take on board.
And we've seen activity stepping up a lot just in the last year or so. How long should we expect it to go on for before it starts to calm down?
The solar cycle lasts about 11 years, so we can expect to see an intensification of these events over the next couple of years, perhaps through to 2013 or 14. If you're watching the sun, you'll be able to see more sunspots, and also the odds of seeing displays of the northern lights of the aurora go up over that time. If you want to find out for yourself, there is a mailing list called Aurora Watch. They have a web page and a Twitter feed and so on, and they send out alerts when there's likely to be a magnetic storm, and you can actually go out and look for them on that basis. It's better than leaving it to chance alone. I should say that it's possible to see them anywhere in the UK. In fact, they can even be seen down in France. But generally, the further north you are, the better. And you do, of course, need a clear sky, and it helps if there's no full moon. But plenty of people have seen them, and they're fantastically beautiful things to watch.
Robert Massey from the Royal Astronomical Society.